found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us. If you're live, hi. Thanks for making us a part of your morning. If you're downloading or listening on demand or on iTunes, thank you for that honor and privilege, too. We appreciate being a part of your lives. You may reach us via the website at MariaSanchezShow.com, also the blog, TheMariaSanchezShow.com, and, of course, through the syndicator here at LATalkRadio.com. If you have some suggestions or you would like something looked into or whatever, please feel free to email. We're really amenable to that sort of thing. One of the first stories we'll cover, we'll go into that because someone contacted me about it over the weekend. It's the Cheerios story, and looked into it and spoke with representatives this morning, so we'll go into that. But continuing with coverage about what's happening in Oklahoma, our disaster correspondent is made himself available in just a moment to talk with us about the five tornadoes that touched down in central Oklahoma and caused flash flooding, as well as the deaths of the three storm chasers. And then later on in the program, we have another local story that is inspirational too. How many times have you thought, geez, I should write a book? Or you know somebody, you think you should write a book. We all have a book in us, but who gets around to doing it? Well, our guest later in the program did. She wrote a book called, it's her autobiography called Mexican Bread. And in it, she talks about her family. She's from a Hispanic family, Latino family in the Los Angeles area, and cooking. And so she's got recipes in it as well as the story of her life. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. A weekend packed with social activities and major home projects. Very productive this weekend, both socially and personally, and then, of course, always keeping a pulse on the news. My latest dilemma is I planted a garden about 6 weeks ago. For the first time, I had a planter built, so it's above ground. Put chicken wire on the bottom so gophers can't get in. Have irrigation for the first time, which I wouldn't do again because I'd prefer the hand watering. But I thought, just in case if I'm not around, the system can take care of itself. And I planted strawberries and bell peppers and cucumbers and basil and beets and arugula and artichokes and tomatoes, excuse me, and six different chili peppers and corn. So corn is just growing. I only six stalks of corn. It's growing. It's about as tall as I am now. And there's these tassels, I've learned, that's what they're called, coming out of the top of the stalk. And they sure don't look like ears of corn. So I didn't know what to do. I go onto the internet, find out that the tassels are the male, and they've got the pollen, and that needs to pollinate the females, the silk. That's fine. I don't know where the silk is. I can't identify that. And they said, and it's done by wind, so not by bees. So I went out there, can't remember, one day over the weekend, and I thought, well, I do get some wind in my backyard, but maybe I'll help. So I blew on the tassels, and sure enough, this little yellow pollen is emitted. But in my research, I found that you can't pollinate the tassel with the silk on the same stalk, so it has to travel to another one. So I was blowing it to do that. And then I went to Facebook, because how else do we solve problems in our life? We go to our family and friends at Facebook. Well, I still haven't solved it. So I'm hoping that my blowing is going to help. I went on to other websites again yesterday, and they say the same thing, but they talk about the silk being the female, and that's going to be what makes an ear of corn. And I can't find where that is. So I'll keep you posted in that regard. So one of the stories I wanted to highlight that has been making the news, and it hasn't been making too much of mainstream news, but Cheerios has a 30-second spot that they uploaded last week to YouTube, and it's been viewed as of, since it was uploaded on Tuesday, this is as of this morning, it's been viewed about a million times, I guess. And it's absolutely precious, and it involves a mother having breakfast at the table, we assume, And her little daughter comes, and her daughter looks to be about 5 years old, comes up to her and asks her the question if the Cheerios are really good for your heart. And the mom says yes, and the little girl runs away with the box of cereal. And in the next scene, there's a man who's asleep on the couch, and he's got clothes on, so they've been up and dressed and whatever, so it's not like he's in pajamas or something. And he wakes up, and there's a pile of Cheerios on his chest, which is just precious. I mean, how cute is that? If it's good for your heart, then she puts it on his heart, right? Well, it's making news because it's a biracial family or interracial family. The mother's Caucasian, the dad's black, and the daughter is a combination of that. She's got this beautiful cafe au lait skin and nice, you know, head of tight curls. I didn't think anything of it, but apparently, because there were so many, they say, a strong racist backlash over the ad's depiction of an interracial couple, Cheerios had to close down the comments section on YouTube. So they say they're not going to be pulling the spot. And we contacted Cheerios over the weekend, and this morning, Camille Gibson, Vice President of Marketing for Cheerios, had this to say. Quote, consumers have responded positively to our new Cheerios ad. At Cheerios, we know there are many kinds of family, and we celebrate them all. So it's difficult to imagine that in this day and age, they said that according to Adweek, the YouTube comments section devolved into an endless flame war with references to Nazis, troglodytes, and racial genocide before it was disabled. So other people have gone to Cheerios Facebook page, and apparently there's more thumbs up there than anything. And one quote on the Facebook page is, as a biracial kid who has never been represented in the media, this meant the world. Thanks, Cheerios. And it reminded me when I was in college, I dated a black man. And when I'm colorblind. I see hearts, souls, morals, integrity, sense of humor. That's what I see in people. And so this black man and I, we actually were colleagues on a student advisory panel. That's how we met. And he asked me out. We had a lot in common. And I was like, sure, of course. So we went out. And then I went to school, a college in Northern California, which was about 70 miles east of San Francisco. And so he said to me, he wanted me to meet his family, which was in the Bay Area. And then let's go to dinner in San Francisco. And I'm like, great. So we go and meet his family. I'm the only white person in the room, which I don't care, and they didn't care. And so after that, we go to dinner, we go to a restaurant, and I swear to goodness, traffic stopped, conversation stopped, people stopped eating, they looked at us, and I was like so uncomfortable, because to me it was no big deal. What's the big deal? This is San Francisco, this is liberal, this is come on. You know, the bastion of all of that, and even still, it was like, no, you don't do that around here. So, fortunately, nothing happened, but whatever. So, speaking of biracial, we've got Kanye West and Kim Kardashian in the news today. Why? Because last night on the 8th season premiere of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, we find out that they're going to have a girl. The episode followed her on her 19-week checkup, and she's actually due next month because, as you may know, these programs are filmed months in advance, and when they say reality, that's not true. It isn't that it didn't happen, but other things happen too. And when you film hours and hours and hours, or tape, I don't know if what this is, tape or film, you capture a lot, so you get to put a point of view that you want to spin the story onto, because you have to edit it down to whatever the program is. Having personally never watched this program, I don't watch TV, period. Unless basically it's a sporting event, and even that is few and far between. But so they're having a girl. She had a shower yesterday in Beverly Hills, and her quote is, I'm so excited we're having a girl. Who doesn't want a girl? I think they are the best. I know that's really what Kanye has always wanted. He wanted a little girl. Cities in the news that are the healthiest, the 50 healthiest U.S. cities, and this is according to the American College of Sports Medicine's American Fitness Index Advisory Board. They released it, and they say that cities that provide parks, walking trails, playing fields, running tracks are setting the standards for our country by having the healthiest urban areas, meaning if you build it, they will come. So Minneapolis, St. Paul topped the list for the third year in a row, which you would think with all their winters that that would be tough to do. But because they know that they're going to be buried in snow, they've created lots of places to exercise indoors. And the report also noted that Minneapolis, St. Paul has a generous per capita number of dog parks, golf courses, and baseball diamonds. More than 76% of Minneapolis, St. Paul residents reported exercising in the past 30 days. So the top favorable cities was Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then it was Washington, D.C., Portland, Oregon, San Francisco, Denver, Colorado, Sacramento, San Jose. And then the worst, and I would hate that, but Oklahoma City, where all of this tornado activity is happening, is at the bottom of the list of the 50. High obesity and smoking rates brought them there. And down at the bottom with them is Memphis, Tennessee, Louisville, Kentucky, San Antonio, Texas, Detroit, Michigan, and then Oklahoma City down at the bottom. So it just goes to show you, if you have opportunities, people are going to take advantage of that. And then rounding out the news this morning, only a third of U.S. adults say they are very happy. Minorities show particularly pronounced declines in the past 2 years. This is a Harris poll. It was conducted last month. They do it every 2 years. And they said they found certain groups, such as minorities, recent graduates, and the disabled, trended downward in the last couple of years. And if you think about recent graduates, they've got their entire lives in front of them, all that opportunity. And if they're not doing well... So Senior Vice President of the Harris Poll, Regina Corso, says our happiness index offers insight into what's on the minds of Americans today and is a reflection of the state of affairs in our country. While the attitudes on the economy may be improving, we're seeing that this is not translating into an improvement in overall happiness. And the happiness index was especially low among the Hispanic American population. And those 50 and older were more likely to be very happy than younger people. Now, I guess you could say when you're 50 plus, you perhaps have done what you wanted to do professionally. You've perhaps pretty much raised your family or have them well on the way. And maybe now you're able to focus on yourself. I know that's true of me and where I'm at in my life. But I still would think that, man, when you get out of school and you've got anything and everything available to you, they would be top in the list, but that's not the case. So we're going to meet now with our disaster correspondent. He is in Oklahoma. He does disaster assessment, and he's going to share with us what it was like Friday with those five storms.
This is Lori. How may I help you?
Hi, room 2107, please.
2107?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. So he's going to visit with us. We always try and get a landline because the cell phones...
Yes, good morning. It's Jeff.
Hi, Jeff. Good morning. You're on the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us again this morning.
Hey there, Maria. It's always great to hear from you.
Thank you. So as our disaster correspondent who has responded to every single tornado and hurricane since about, what, 2002?
That's right, exactly, 2002.
And you've got a fair amount of history, obviously more than any of us, since I've only been to one with the American Red Cross. And we spoke with you last week about the initial damage that was done, and then, lo and behold, Friday, five tornadoes touched down. And the worst thing about Friday was, because it was during the commuter time, lots of folks in their cars.
Right, exactly, which is the worst place to be. And last week was a 60% chance of a tornado outbreak within a 50-mile radius, and this week, today, it's actually a 40% chance. So, you know, we were talking about that last week, is that there's a 60% chance that, you know, just to you know, put it into perspective, that there's a 60% chance of you getting into a car accident today, or versus now, you know, today it's a 40% chance. So it's scary. You know, people are watching the Weather Channel and listening to the news and stuff. And unfortunately, a lot of people did not get out of the Reno area until late. The local freeway here, which my hotel is actually adjacent to, which is I-35, was absolutely jam-packed. And what's really frightening is that lots of deaths are caused because of car accidents, you know, as well. You know, people are starting to panic. You know, I completely understand why, because when there is a tornado that is coming down or, you know, that you're facing, or a, you know, hurricane, and you just procrastinated, you know, you get scared. And unfortunately, lots of people got scared. You know, lots of people did foolish things, and, you know, lots of people died too.
Well, and of course, the bigger news is bad timing, and it set her with all the folks in the cars, and I heard it was bumper to bumper, and it was stopped, basically. It was gridlock. But that the three storm chasers were among those that were killed on Friday, and that would be Tim Samaras, who's the founder of the tornado research company Twistex, along with his son, Paul Samaras, and then Carl Young, who's a meteorologist with their company. There they are. They were killed in El Reno that you were just mentioning.
Yeah, and that is so devastating. I mean, you know, to the whole scientific industry and field and stuff. And that was, you know, obviously so unfortunate. The El Reno tornado started out in a very rural part of Oklahoma. And the problem with that was that there weren't very many streets. So if, you know, you get out there in the farmlands and stuff, it's like there's one street, one cross street every mile. So if you're stuck on one road going north and south, okay, and you're trying to get away from a tornado that's coming right at you, you can't go east or west because it's all farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the situation that they were confronted with, as well as tornadoes can turn on a dime. It's just amazing. There's no rhyme or reason or things like that. So, you know, it's unfortunate. It's very unfortunate.
And do you want to tell our listeners what exactly it is that you're doing there? And why you're there, because most people leave, and you live in Southern California, and you went.
Well, yes, I've been doing this now since 2002, and I wanted to find a way that I can actually give back, and so I was able to take my construction industry, you know, skills that I have developed, and I became a catastrophe insurance adjuster, so when a storm hits, my phone starts ringing, and then we are placed on a standby list. And so when people are leaving, we are gearing up, you know, to go in there. And it's, you know, it's all about helping people in need. I mean, so, and it's my way of using my skills to give back. We try to help out people as quickly as possible, you know, get them money, you know, get them food, supplies, whatever they need to basically get through their actual that time of need.
So if people don't understand, I mean, you're doing this, this is a position that you're doing, but how you're able to help is when you have insurance on something, i.e. your car or your dwelling, even if it's renter's insurance, you have benefits that you're entitled to, but somebody has to execute that decision to what benefits you are able to avail yourselves of and how. So Jeff is on the ground doing that so that people can start getting their lives back together and hopefully reconstruct their home or their apartment or the condo or townhome or whatever. So I don't think people think about that. They just go, oh, well, I have insurance. Well, yeah, how does it happen that you have damage and then you get something? There's a person like you that's in interfacing between the system and the client.
Yes. Unfortunately, I have flown back here during, you know, holidays, see my wife's anniversary, my own birthday, which was just this last May 23rd. So, you know, so I actually spent my birthday here in a hotel room. And like lots of people don't understand that when we come here to volunteer and work, we are thrown into the same sort of a disaster zone or war zone that the survivors are at.
Mm-hmm.
There's oftentimes we don't have power, we don't have food or water, things like that. So we try to prepare all, you know, as best as we can. But there's actually some, you know, information that I would like to, you know, share with you and your listeners, Maria, because it's really amazing, you know, the difference between tornado and a hurricane, if I may.
Yes.
You know, like last week we were talking about how a tornado, it's like a blender. I mean, it's just, you know, the actual devastation is just, it just, you know, takes everything and it just blends it all up and spits it out, versus a, you know, hurricane is much more of like a softer devastation, whereas the fence starts to blow down very slowly, and then it hits the ground, and then maybe another wind gust will go ahead and pick that up and then cause secondary devastation through going through a window or things like that. That's always the fear of a hurricane. So the difference between the two, okay, let's just take Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, okay, which basically affected 28 states. Not sure whether your listeners knew that or not, but it actually covered 95,000 square miles of territory here, and it caused over $50 billion of estimated damage.
So they've upped that figure, because I keep hearing 38, 39 billion.
Yeah, it was just updated this last month here. So now it's up to 50 billion, okay? And whereas Tornado Moore, okay, it actually affected 13,000 homes, 13 dead. That caused $5 billion worth of damage. So that just kind of shows you that a, and basically Hurricane Moore, or apartment, Tornado Moore was 20 square miles. 20 square miles, it caused $5 billion worth of damage.
So that's almost a fifth of Sandy.
It's actually, it would be...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Wow, my math is way off.
No. I actually did the math on it, and it's 0.0002, okay, as to the actual land mass that was affected versus, you know, Hurricane Sandy. Now, Hurricane Sandy, okay, was only a Category 1 hurricane, okay, and which is... The difference between the Category 1 hurricane is it's 95 miles per hour. That's a Category 1.
Mm-hmm.
A F5 tornado, mm-hmm. which is what affected more, is upwards of 261 to 318 miles per hour. Now, a Category 5 hurricane, which of course we all know which was Katrina. Okay, that's only 157 sustained miles per hour. So tornado is very violent, and that's why it causes the actual destruction. And unfortunately, that's why there are so many deaths with a F4, F5 hurricane, which actually only accounts. This is actually pretty interesting. For 1% of all of the tornadoes is an F4 or an F5 tornado. However, the death toll from that 1% is 67% of all of the tornado deaths. So
they're lethal. They're just
very
lethal.
Now,
F4s, F5s, are they predominantly in this tornado alley? Because I was at a Red Cross reunion yesterday, and we were talking. All of us have been deployed. We were all directors at one point, and now we're all volunteers. And they were like, if you know you live in a tornado alley, why wouldn't you? And we're like, well, yeah, we're in Southern California, earthquake country. But still, it's
right.
You know, it's the exception, not the norm.
Exactly, exactly.
This is an annual event.
This is an annual event, not necessarily a F4 or F5.
Right, but it's going to happen in May, usually.
4 months out of the year, that's right. And so... Storm shelters are huge here. I mean, there's lots of local stories about families of four and five and their three dogs getting into a little 5x5 closet, which is basically down in there, that is built underground in their garage, and that's what saved their lives. As a F3 tornado completely demolished their house. So
now. Yeah, you mentioned philanthropy, and have you seen, because I know the Salvation Army responds, I know that Lutheran Services responds, of course I know the American Red Cross responds, because there are still needs. I'm still getting emails to ask if I'm available for deployment. Have you seen that on the streets? Do you see that with your own eyes?
It really warms my heart here. After seeing all this devastation and like you hear all of the politics and this and that, you know, it's just amazing how far or what people will do, you know, to help out other people. And really, for all of your listeners, if you haven't already, please just make that cell phone $10 donation if you can, okay? You know, because there are lots of people here in need. There are people I have seen and spoke to, okay, folks that have driven 4 states away just to hand out water on the street corner. I saw that back in Joplin 2 years ago, and I saw that out here or see it out here. Every single church that is in operation, even some that are not even in operation, they have some sort of a disaster relief staging area there. Whereas they are volunteers are handing out food, you know, hot food, water, diapers, toilet paper, used clothes, whatever people are dropping off, and it's just so incredible. I was speaking with a woman yesterday at a local church whereas I got a hot meal because we get into these areas and they're still cordoned off by the local officials, so it's very hard to get out of there. So I stopped in, had a hot meal, and then went back to work. But the this gal was saying that there are very few homeless people here in Oklahoma. Now, there's lots of people without a home, but there's very few homeless people. And the reason for that is that people have actually taken other people into their own homes so that they can help them out. It's just amazing. But, you know, if you haven't texted the $10 in, think about even joining a relief organization such as you did, Maria, the Red Cross or volunteer. I mean, summer's coming up. NOAA is predicting at least 20 hurricanes this year, and it's so fulfilling to show up at a disaster site and hand out food, hand out water, and even just give people hugs, because that's really what they need, because they just lost everything. And if you want to really show your kids what life is really about, bring them on down here and let them help out too.
Well, and I should caution that good intentions can sometimes not necessarily be channeled to where you want them to go. So I would suggest that you go through an organization because they have an intake system and a training system where you actually will have tools and you'll be able to know what it is that needs to be done. I know that's true with the American Red Cross, especially in times of disaster. They have an expedited system where whatever your strengths are and your availability is, they'll match you with the needs of the community. And some of that even is client casework where they do the same thing about what are your damages, what are your needs, and then, you know, they work with other agencies. It's mutual aid at its finest.
Absolutely, and volunteering can be fun, too. There's one organization, it's called Operation Barbecue Relief. Now, these guys, what they do is that they offer hot foods, hot barbecue food, and I was doing some research on them. They have been deployed 71 days last year, and they handed out over 327,000 meals. That's just amazing.
And just think about that, Operation Barbecue. Now, one thing I do have to caution, because since I was deployed and you're talking about the hardships, when the areas are impacted, so are you. I slept for a week on a cot in a basketball gymnasium at a university because all the motels were taken up by public works folks who had been flown in so they can start to get the infrastructure up and running, and obviously that makes more sense. After a week, there was some rooms, and so we were able to be placed into motels. But I haven't slept on a cot in decades. And there were 400 other volunteers in that same gymnasium, and I haven't slept with that many people in my entire life. So it's not luxurious by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not about that. It's about helping to make a difference.
You're exactly right. And listen, we all understand the tragedy, and of course we don't want to lose sight that the people lost their lives here and that there was, major destruction. Okay. After accepting that, I mean, just to see the outpour of just the love and the support, you know, from fellow Americans, it's just, it is so heartwarming.
Mm-hmm. Including
knowing that there is generosity out there. There are people that are you know, handing out. There is one guy who is a multi-millionaire, had a construction company. He closed his company down, moved a whole bunch of equipment down here, and just started, you know, clearing lots mm-hmm. for free. It's just amazing how people, especially here in the heartland, they're really doing. And I hope that in L.A. when the earthquake happens, I hope that the people will do that there too.
Well, Jeff, thank you for your time again, and please stay safe. And don't get in your car.
Well, yes, and I know there's a 40% you know, chance of a tornado today, and so I will be watching the Weather Channel as I'm working out of my room today doing paperwork. But thank you so much, Maria, and listen, you're doing a great job as well, you know, getting the word out there, and this is really what people need to hear and you know, understand, is that even though that maybe 2 weeks from now when it's out of the news cycle, mm-hmm. people in these disaster areas still need your help, mm-hmm. and whether it's rebuilding, money, clothes, you know, whatever. So.
Time. Yep. Thank you, Jeff, very much. Stay safe. Look forward to our next conversation. Jeff is our disaster correspondent, and having responded to all the major storms that, you know, Ike and Ivan and Katrina and Sandy, et cetera, he's got a great perspective to it. And again, the sadness with the passing of the storm chasers, I've always thought of them as like adrenaline buffs or something, or adrenaline junkies, and they're known, you know, as risk takers, right? But this, the fellow who founded the company, Tim Samaras, it's Twistex, it's based in Colorado, and he founded it to collect the temperature, humidity, pressure, and wind speed data, and the goal was to increase the lead times for tornado warnings. So he was doing it to empower us to have better knowledge so that there's, you know, less damage and more lives saved. So some of his research was funded by 18 grants that he received over the years from the National Geographic Society. And his son, as we mentioned, was killed too, Paul, age 24, Tim, age 55. And then their colleague, Carl Young, 45, who was a meteorologist with Twistex. He had been chasing storms with Samaras since 2003. Both men were featured in the Disney Discovery Channel series Storm Chasers and had contributed to the Weather Channel. Now, the three employees of the Weather Channel suffered minor injuries when their sport utility vehicle was thrown about 200 yards by the winds while tracking the El Reno storm on Friday. So they're saying that they're going to have to assess what and how they allow them to do what needs to be done. So one of the quotes from a colleague said, a friend and fellow storm chaser said, Tim Samaras was the best there was, and he was the last person you would think this would happen to. It's going to bring everybody down to earth. A lot of chasing has been getting very, very careless, and Tim is not a careless person. He is as nimble and skilled as he could be. So wrong place, wrong time. The interesting thing about Samaras, he said he's been enthralled by tornadoes ever since he was a child. Why? Because he was forced to watch the movie, The Wizard of Oz. And, of course, as we know, there's a tornado scene there, right? He was quoted as saying, that tornado was the best part of the entire movie. From that day, I was hooked for the rest of my life. So you take something that you love and you do it, and you made a difference in the world, and now he's gone. It's another quote said, he died doing what he loved and literally put his life on the line to save others. He's mostly going to be remembered as somebody who tried to help save lives. That's his brother's comment on that. So may they rest in peace. And I can't, you know, my heart goes out for the family that's suffering that loss, not to mention the devastation. Of course, they're probably in Colorado. And before we get to our next guest, there's a story that we didn't have time to chat about last week that involves vanity. And I'm bringing it forward because it's still something that I think is relevant, because I just saw an interview with a gal who's taking her L-shaped sized breasts, and she's having them enhanced to a triple M. She's going to be in a record maker in the world of breast augmentation. And, you know, it's like really, I think she said they weigh now 10 pounds each. And so she, so this poor gal, it's a woman from Los Angeles, had always felt like she was told she had a flat butt, pancake butt. So she always wanted to get it enhanced. And she was introduced to somebody who has pumping parties where unqualified practitioners inject illegal silicone into people in their home. And so she had that done. The gal told her that she was probably going to need four procedures. She did two of them. And she, it turns out that the injections were a bathroom sealant. So she went for the two treatments, didn't return for the three and four. Over the next 2 years, the area where she'd been injected became hard and the skin blackened. Within a few months of the second injection, her buttocks began to harden. Shame kept her from seeking medical help. As time went on, the skin got darker. She developed lumps, then the searing pain. So she finally told her doctor. After 4 years in constant pain, two surgeons told her it was too dangerous to remove the silicone. She said, I was in so much agony, I became a regular at the hospital asking for medication to ease what was like a combination of a migraine, childbirth, and toothache localized in one area. So in February of 2011, a surgeon operated unsuccessfully. She developed a hole in her butt. They thought that that's what triggered the infection. She nearly died. She was 24 hours from dying. So doctors induced her into a coma for 2 months. They performed 27 surgeries, starting with amputating her butt and doing extensive skin grafts. Gangrene set into her hands and feet. And the long and the short of it is she had her hands and her feet and her butt amputated. And she's alive, and she's going public with this because she says, I thought that this was going to make me happy. And the truth is that her life, you know, what's really interesting too is she says, I haven't sued or sought compensation. I just want to move on. There are things I miss dearly. I'll never be able to do my girl's hair or feel sand between my toes. But the story has some good news in it. She decided to do a triathlon. And she trained for it. She made her first steps by the end of 2011. So she trains, and she did finish the triathlon. So here's her quote. My greatest message is we have to learn to love and accept ourselves for who we are. So just kind of keep that in mind if you're thinking about something. Not that any procedures are bad, but how about if we just go with what God gave us and enjoy it as best we can. So now we have a nice, hopeful story. Local girl, local gal. Maricela.
Hello.
Maricela. Hi. Avalar Scott. Yes. Good morning. You're on the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you for making yourself available this morning.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
I was sharing with our listeners that people think, and I'm one of them too, that, you know, should write a book because we, all of us, I believe, have very interesting things and paths in our lives. But most people don't get around to it. And so I think your story not only is one of inspiration on many levels, but maybe it will empower folks who have been sitting on their hands and not sharing their story to do so. So what caused you to write Mexican Bread and weaving in recipes and telling your story? Was there something that you thought, hey, other people need to know this?
To start with, I decided to write this book because my mother passed away 9 years ago. It was a very, very difficult time for me, and I noticed that some of our family memories were kind of fading away, and the stories that I recall, and they were just in my mind. There's some funny ones, happy ones. I decided I'm going to put this story, write this book, so I can share it with other people and my experiences, and it's kind of also, I wanted to, in myself, brand my parents, that my mom and dad, they did so much for me and for my family growing up, and that I wanted, it's like, well, their memory, our family story will never go away. If I write a book, it's published, it's there forever, it's here to stay, and generations and other people will read it for many, many years to come.
And how did you go about, did you just sit down and write, or did you use the computer, and did you start when you were born? Or
Yes. Well, I'm a hairstylist, and during my appointments, there's a lot of free time in between. I would sit there with just a notepad and paper, and I would write down my notes and things that I would remember. And then I started telling my husband, and my husband was the one that said, you know, you should put it on in the computer and put it in a file. And from that moment on, I said, yeah, it's a lot easier. And every night I would start writing, and I started asking my brother, my sister, do you remember this? Yes, you know, certain things. But it took me a good 2 years mm-hmm. to write this. And it took me a little courage, because I will admit it was a little bit scary. I always say writing that book was like writing in my own personal diary, except I'm going to have to let the world see it.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Because you're right, my emotions are there, my thoughts, certain personal things, that little things that I never really share with others, from being bullied and to how I felt when my father passed away. And yes, you know, I feel like if I can do it, anyone should. And if you have a story to sit down and write it, and take your time. I've had wonderful emails, and people come up to me and tell me, Maricela, I can relate to that chapter. I can relate to the story. And I remember growing up eating Mexican bread to go to the bakery with my father, and or like, you know, little things with family gatherings and parties and things that I wrote. And I'm very proud of my book.
Tell me, Maricela, what is Mexican bread?
Mexican bread is pan dulce in Spanish.
Okay.
I started writing Mexican, I titled it Mexican Bread, because every day my family would eat Mexican bread. Every day my mom and my dad would say, who's going to go to the bakery and buy Mexican bread? And every day my grandmother would either, usually it was milk or hot chocolate, my grandmother would make from scratch. And, you know, and we would sit there and we'd talk. Mexican bread was like our companion, from funerals to parties to wedding anniversaries. You know, it's Mexican bread. It's always, we created a lot of family history while we were sitting there. We discussed issues and we solved problems while sitting there eating Mexican bread with either milk, hot chocolate, and I said, you know, Mexican bread, I'm going to title my book.
Now, you didn't bake it yourselves. You went to a bakery.
Yes, yeah, I know. I've had a lot of people asking me that. But I decided to include some of my mother and grandmother's recipes, because they did a lot of cooking from scratch. They were old school, my grandmother and mother. They didn't believe in olive oil. They cooked with lard and the best authentic ingredients they can find here in the United States. But I decided I'm going to include a few recipes, so maybe some people who are willing to try it and cook some of the recipes. I mean, you can alter the ingredients, of course, but it's not about me baking. I wish.
Do you have a recipe? Were you raised having sopaipillas?
No, but I was raised growing up with my mother making homemade flour tortillas and corn tortillas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my grandmother and mother would make them even on the, I still remember they would make them from scratch, and Sunday morning they would make the refried beans, and they'll make their chilaquiles and authentic Mexican breakfasts, or they'll make large pots of menudo, which I always call it our Mexican version of our brunch.
Yeah,
I always tease. Yeah. This is our version of Mexican brunch.
Now, it's funny because my mom's family was raised in New Mexico, and so there's definitely a Mexican influence, but there's a Spanish one too. So she never had a flour tortilla her entire life. Her mom used to make, when we would go and visit every morning, she would make a stack of corn tortillas, and that would last the day for all three meals. That was what the bread was. So it's interesting that you had both.
Yes. Yeah, but everyone had different tastes. I will admit that they both were delicious to me. There's some of my brother would love corn tortillas made by hand, and I myself enjoy homemade flour tortillas. I can just, you know, when they were nice and fluffy, and they were so delicious with butter on top.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite.
And the padding of the hands, because it's labor intensive to do it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember, I think I'm the only one from my four sisters, that never really learned. I can do them, but I cannot, they won't turn out like the way my mother and grandmother turned out. I always tell my husband, I don't have that little thing that my grandma, that little palm of their hands. I don't know the flavors, everything so different from when they made it.
Yeah. Well, and the lard is something I remember too, because it was big vats of this white thick stuff.
Oh.
And
I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah.
It was used a lot.
Yeah.
I remember making Christmas for Christmas Eve before. We would make tamales, and my mom hated dry flaky tamales. So did my grandmother. They would buy everything from scratch, even the unprepared masa they would use, the dough. And my mother would be, just kneading the dough by hand. And, of course, gently my mother would take her hands out, and my grandmother would pour the melted lard until it cooled off. Mm-hmm. Then my mother would continue to mix it. She said this is what gave the tamales the flavor.
Mm-hmm. Tamales and rellenos are so labor intensive. There's
very
no easy
so.
Way around them. So how did you pick which recipes to put in your book?
Some of them are my favorites, actually. Like some of my very favorites. I decided to put chile rellenos in my book because it's a lot. But they're labor intense. They're really authentic recipes. So it's not like little short version. My mother, again, they didn't believe in making the little short version. I also put how to make jericallas. This is like a dessert. Sangria. Some of the desserts. Arroz con leche, which was one of my family's favorites. It's like rice pudding. I also put how to make hot Mexican hot chocolate, but either with water or with milk. Cause we all had different tastes in our family.
And how did you decide that your story was done or complete or finished or when to end the book?
I think I ended it when at the end of the story with my mother passing away.
And she must not have been very old.
No, my mother was actually 71 when she passed away, and my father was also 71 when he passed away. 12 years apart.
Oh, so she was the sweet young thing.
Yeah. It was very difficult, and I think a lot of people have also mentioned to me they can actually feel my emotion. And I just recently I had one of my nephews, his wife read my book, and she had her father passed away, and she says, Mari, I was actually sobbing. Because I can feel your writing. I can just feel your tears. And I said, it is very, there's some happy parts, but there's also some very sad. And I didn't mind sharing them because I'm sure other people will relate to this.
Well, I just wanted to congratulate you on making not only the effort, but actually executing it, and as an inspiration for us all. And the fact that you take a story and then you weave in the recipes is also fairly unique. I think it was the autobiography of, no, it wasn't. It was a gal who wrote about Julia Child, and she wrote about some of the recipes. So you're kind of in uncharted territory, which is nice. So tell our listeners how they can avail themselves of Mexican bread.
Oh, I can give you my website, and they can go into my website, and it's www.mexicanbreadthebook.com.
Okay.
We'll post that. They can go in there, and they can see everything, where from the beginning to the end of my journey when I started with my book, in their newspapers, where they can get my book. And I also started, and I love to reinvent myself, Maria. So it's like I always start, I'm on my third book, starting my new third book, and I started another venture. So it's important for me.
Good for you.
I'm not afraid.
Good.
I have to.
Excellent.
Continue.
That's a great, great message. Marcella, thank you so much for your time and continued success.
Oh, thank you so much, Maria. Also for inviting me to your show, and I truly appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you. Have a great day. And again, Marcella approached me via the internet, via the website, so I'm open if the story falls along. We try to empower, we try to give knowledge, we try to inspire as much as possible, so if there's something that you'd like us to know about, let us know. This is the Maria Sanchez Show. Have a great day. I look forward to visiting with you tomorrow morning.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.